This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, traveler. Can you handle the truth? I didn't think so. Me neither. But it will happen anyway. Science is beginning to prove we have already changed the planet's climate in dangerous ways. A small group of climate scientists, backed by a billionaire and big oil, are considering taking over control of the climate to stave off disaster. Then we'll find proof our current 400 parts per million will melt so much Arctic and Antarctic ice, warming up to 8 degrees C, that global coasts will flood the world's largest cities. We'll wrap up with one of the few positive alternatives growing in this disturbed scene, a wake of bike sharing around the world. It can work. Gather round, boys and girls, as we tell the story of Earthmasters, the men who would take over from nature to run the climate of the world. Or do they mean to save us from our fossil-addicted selves? For all who love a good conspiracy, geoengineering has it all, the oil companies, far-right think tanks, nuclear weapons scientists, and even Bill Gates. But you have to hang in a little bit while we first look at a few small problems in their plans. Our guide is Clive Hamilton. After careers in the Australian Public Service as an economics and resource advisor and several stints at universities like Yale, Cambridge, and Oxford, Hamilton founded and ran a progressive think tank called the Australia Institute. Now he's professor of public ethics in a program run by two Australian universities. You may have heard of books Clive has written or co-written, including Growth Fetish, Affluenza, Silencing Dissent, and more recently, Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change. But his latest book is Earthmasters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering. We've reached Clive Hamilton in Canberra. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
Well, it's good to connect with you, and I begin maybe a little facetiously by saying your book is full of some great news. It's a real relief. We just have to pump a bit of sea salt into the air, and we can go on burning fossil fuels as before, even if we double the CO2 in the atmosphere. What are some scientists proposing to stop global warming? Try and make a little case for them.
Well, the idea of geoengineering has now come onto the international climate change agenda because the climate scientists themselves became very worried at the failure of the world to respond to their warnings. So the argument is that if Plan A, reducing global greenhouse gas emissions, isn't working, shouldn't we have Plan B? And that's where they started to develop these geoengineering ideas, a whole string of technologies that would either suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, or to put some kind of solar shield between the Earth and the Sun to cool the planet by basically reducing the amount of sunlight that reaches planet Earth.
Well, it's that latter one I want to talk to you most about, solar radiation management. Who named it that, and did he come up with another name for it?
Well, there's one of the more prominent scientists involved in researching geoengineering, Ken Caldera at Stanford University, came up with the term solar radiation management, although more recently he's decided that perhaps sunlight reflection methods would be a term that would less likely frighten the horses. He came up with that term, he wrote, because talking about geoengineering would be too scary for some bureaucrats, and he was wanted to get some money to hold a seminar at NASA, and he was worried that geoengineering or climate engineering might make them a bit afraid, so he came up with his idea of solar radiation management. But of course, as soon as you think about it, managing the amount of solar radiation which reaches planet Earth, I mean, that's a pretty scary thought. And when you consider the primary method that is being put forward, it becomes scarier. And that method is essentially to surround the entire Earth in the upper atmosphere with a layer of so-called sulfate aerosols, tiny particles, essentially a kind of pollution, same kind of pollution that causes acid rain, but this time way, way up in the stratosphere. And because it's a pollution, these tiny particles would basically, depending on how much you put up there, reduce the amount of incoming solar radiation by perhaps 1 or 2%, thereby cooling the planet.
Isn't that the same as happens when volcanoes go off?
It is, and in fact, the idea for sulfate aerosol spraying as a method of geoengineering was prompted by observations over 100 years or more of the impact on the Earth's climate of major volcanic eruptions. Mount Pinatubo, for example, in 1991 in the Philippines, was a massive eruption, and it put so much volcanic ash and other particles and soot into the atmosphere that once it had circled the globe, it cooled the planet for half a degree or more for a couple of years. So that gave rise to the idea of, well, what if we could control the amount of this kind of sulfate aerosol in the upper atmosphere, say with a fleet of specially equipped aircraft that would go up on a regular basis and spray the precursor chemicals, sulfur dioxide or sulfuric acid, which would then in the upper atmosphere form sulfate particles and basically put a kind of thin shield around the Earth, which then whoever controlled it could turn up or down to offset the impacts of warming due to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Well, right, but then the next point you raise, I believe you used the term spine chilling, is what happens if we succeed in cooling the planet but then can't manage to keep the program going. You used the year 2059, I believe. What happens?
Well, this is one of a string of fairly frightening possibilities arising from sulfate aerosol spraying. A lot of modelling work has been done using big global climate models, but there has been no testing of it yet. One of the difficulties is that if we did, we, the global community, and, you know, there is a question of whether it would be the global community that did it or one power, China or United States maybe, but if we, the global community, decided to do it, we would need to do it for at least 10 years before we had enough data to be able to separate out the effects of sulfate aerosol spraying from the effects of global warming and natural climate variability. But building on that, the whole point about solar radiation management is it's not trying to counter human-induced climate change, but simply to deal with one of the symptoms. Okay, so one of the symptoms of human-induced climate change, and you know, the main one, is a warming globe. And so rather than tackle the source of the problem, that is burning fossil fuels and putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, sulfate aerosol spraying would try to counter one of the impacts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So basically it's suppressing the warming that's happening. It's countering it by putting this solar shield around the Earth. And so the question is, well, if we had to stop, if we had to take down the solar shield for some reason, maybe there was a really big unintended consequence, like it had a major effect, negative effect on rainfall patterns around the world, or let's say there's a big international conflict about the solar shield and it was stopped. We stopped sending the planes up, we stopped spraying the sulfate aerosols, and within a year or so, all of these sulfur particles fall out of the upper atmosphere. The problem is that we'll then have decades and decades of suppressed warming. Let's say we turned it off in 2060. We'd have decades of suppressed warming as we continue to pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, if indeed we did do that, and then there would be a huge rush of this warming that would happen very, very quickly. And as you know, the damage to ecosystems from global warming is due more to the rapidity of warming rather than the amount of warming, because if it's faster warming, ecosystems have less time to adapt. So this whole question is called the termination problem. Could we, once we'd started, could we actually terminate it, or would we be locked into this solar radiation management virtually in perpetuity?
Right, for generations to come. You mentioned rainfall, and you go into some detail in the book Earthmasters about the possibilities of rainfall changing in big ways. Could you talk to us for a minute about that?
Well, one of the big rainfall or precipitation events in the global climate system is, of course, the so-called Indian monsoon, which happens with great regularity each year, and which is obviously crucial to irrigated agriculture over a vast swathe of the Indian subcontinent. And so a billion or more people depend on the Indian monsoon for their food supplies. One of the modelling studies using these global climate models looked at the impact on precipitation around the world of sulfate aerosol spraying and concluded that it's possible that the change to the global weather patterns as a result of sulfate aerosol spraying would be to shift the Indian monsoon, essentially from over India, Pakistan, sort of southwest over more towards Africa. And if that were to happen, of course, there would be a great drought in those regions and potentially severe effects on food supplies. I should say other modelling studies have suggested that that probably won't happen. But the fact that this is a possibility really opens up some very worrying implications and really points to the question of, well, who would control the global climate? And this question of governance, I mean, we're not even at that stage of thinking seriously about it yet. But given that global warming is continuing apace, the growth of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is accelerating, the prospect of engineering the climate is a very real one, and it's time now, and in a way this is why I wrote my book Earthmasters, for the world community to get involved so that if a time does come where it's seriously considered to take control of the Earth's climate, then it's not just the powerful few that have a say, but the world community as a whole.
Yeah, should it be Dick Cheney or perhaps the leader of North Korea? It's pretty hard to decide who in this world is ready to control the climate. Why can't we experiment with this first in some faraway part of the world to see whether the theory works?
For other geoengineering techniques, and I should say that sulfate aerosol spraying is kind of the headline technology, but there are a number of others which are being tested in various ways, less scary ones in some cases. But sulfate aerosol spraying, really, you can't test it because to see what effect it would have on the global weather patterns and certainly on the Earth's temperature, you can't do an experiment. You have to actually do it. You have to do the lot. You have to put up the sulfate aerosol shield and see what happens. So if you just went up over, over the ocean somewhere and sprayed some sulfuric acid into the upper atmosphere, I mean, it might tell you, be very valuable, telling you something about the chemistry of the upper atmosphere and where the aerosols do form and in the way anticipated, but you couldn't find out what impact sulfate aerosol spraying would have on the global climate, on warming, on precipitation, on the ozone layer, for example, without actually implementing the scheme as a whole. So if we ever do it, it will be a gamble because we'll never really know with a great degree of confidence how it will work until we've actually done it.
Clive, does that mean we can't do regional climate control? Like, for example, some are advocating we could do it to save the Arctic sea ice.
No, well, some are advocating that. I mean, some serious people are advocating that. Not only are they advocating it, they're saying we should be doing it now. We should be doing it to slow down or prevent the melting of the sea ice in the Arctic. The problem, of course, is that if you go up there in the Arctic high up and spray sulfate aerosols, well, they soon start blowing around the world and dispersing. And so you have to have a continuing program of spraying sulfate aerosols over the Arctic, which protects the Arctic for a while, but very soon, within days or weeks, it gets blown around the world. And so it's very difficult to really isolate a particular area and to concentrate the activity on deflecting solar radiation from a particular part of the world.
This is Radio EcoShock with Clive Hamilton, an Australian intellectual and author of the new book, Earthmasters. I'm Alex Smith, and yes, we are talking about geoengineering to save the world, maybe. Clive, there's an old saying, you can't tell the players without a program. Your book has a pretty good outline of the people and institutions championing man-made climate control. Why not tell us about two of the key movers, Ken Caldera, who you've mentioned, and David Keith? Who are they?
Ken Caldera and David Keith are extremely well-regarded and accomplished climate scientists. K- Ken Caldera, as I mentioned, is at Stanford, and David Keith is at Harvard, formerly at the University of Calgary for many years. And they are extremely active in the geoengineering research arena, to the point where an earlier author dubbed them the geo-clique. And they are extremely active. They're very concerned about climate change, and which is why they are investigating geoengineering. Although, as I explain in the book, I think both of them have some kind of odd attitudes to global climate change. But one of the reasons why they're so important is that some years ago they became the principal advisors on climate change to Bill Gates. And Bill Gates was so impressed with their intelligence and commitment that he allocated several million dollars to a fund to conduct research into geoengineering technologies. So Caldera and Keith have been administering this fund for research, and it has also led, their influence has led Bill Gates himself to start investing in a number of companies which developing geoengineering technologies. One of them, for example, one of the companies that he's associated with is called Intellectual Ventures. The CEO is a man called Nathan Myhrvold, who was formerly the chief technology officer at Microsoft. Another man associated with Intellectual Ventures is named Lowell Wood. Now, Lowell Wood is an extremely interesting character. He was for many years, decades, until he left fairly recently, one of the gurus of weapons research, nuclear weapons research, at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of the two major Cold War weapons research laboratories. Livermore is located outside San Francisco. Lowell Wood was the protege of Edward Teller, the so-called father of the hydrogen bomb and one of the foremost Cold War architects. And so Lowell Wood and Edward Teller were responsible not only for Star Wars, the ill-fated venture for a missile shield, which the US could use space-based missile shield to defend against or indeed attack the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but they also, in the late 1990s, Lowell Wood and Edward Teller wrote one of the very first papers on geoengineering. And so in the book I investigate the kind of links between geoengineering and Cold War thinking. If you reflect on it a bit, here we have with geoengineering, potentially at least, a vast technological plan to take control of planet Earth. This is in the grander designs. There are much more localized and benign forms of geoengineering to which this kind of analysis doesn't apply. But when it comes to sulfate aerosol spraying, you've got what I call a sort of Promethean vision to use technology to control nature, not just bits of nature, not just ecosystems or a river system or, you know, with a dam or something like that, or to carve out new ports using nuclear explosions, which Edward Teller was very keen to do, but to actually take control using technology of the planet's operating system in its entirety. And so, in a way, this is my main concern, that in some parts of the geoengineering community, there is this Promethean ambition for control. I should say that there are others in the United States, and more particularly in Europe, who take a very different view of geoengineering. Even though they support research into geoengineering, they're far more humble, far more circumspect, far more worried about unintended consequences and the political misuse of geoengineering. So in a way, there's a kind of split within the geoengineering community between those who are very worried, in fact terrified about climate change and think with heavy hearts that we have to investigate Plan B, and others who get very excited about Plan B because they see it as the opportunity for mankind, and I use the word deliberately, to use our unique position, our technological genius, to finally take control of the Earth and subdue it.
Ah, we become the Earth masters. Well, there's others waiting in the wings. I could see how this would really benefit the oil companies. They could keep on selling their products. What multinational oil companies are already involved in the geoengineering scene?
Well, of course, the oil companies and other fossil fuel companies realize they have to be very careful here because, like national governments that could be reducing carbon dioxide emissions but aren't or are only pretending to, the oil companies can be accused of trying to essentially torpedo Plan A, reducing carbon dioxide emissions, by promoting this bright, shiny Plan B. Nevertheless, the oil companies have quietly started to take an interest in geoengineering. ExxonMobil, for example, and there's no company or indeed organization in the world that's done more to try to undermine the credibility of climate science and to stop nations, particularly the US, from adopting policies to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. But ExxonMobil has an expert named Haroon Keshki, has an expert in geoengineering who's quietly been participating in task forces which looking at geoengineering and advocating more research. Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, is supporting research into geoengineering technology known as ocean liming. ConocoPhillips is supporting in Africa and elsewhere another geoengineering technology called biochar, a more benign technology compared to sulfate aerosol spraying, much more benign, and a lot of environmentalists support biochar. But the fact that ConocoPhillips is putting quite a lot of money into developing biochar as a kind of plan B for global warming certainly should set some alarm bells ringing.
Even the American Enterprise Institute, which took big oil money to deny climate change for years, has come out in favor of geoengineering, you write. For what? For a problem that doesn't exist? Help me, Clive. My brain is melting trying to make this connect.
It is very bizarre, isn't it? Until you start to think about it more carefully. So here we have these right-wing think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, which for a decade or more has been actively working to repudiate, undermine, deny climate change science. And whenever any measure, state or national, to reduce carbon dioxide emissions has been put forward, has embarked on a campaign to attack it for all usual right-wing reasons about government control and environmentalist secret agenda and so on and so forth. And so here you have them, nevertheless, supporting geoengineering. And the reason for it is that geoengineering sort of reverses the whole problem of human-induced climate change. Geoengineering, when it's put forward as a substitute for cutting carbon emissions, promises to turn a drastic failure of the free enterprise system into a triumph of human ingenuity. So instead of climate change being a vindication, a terrible vindication of the warnings of environmentalists, geoengineering exposes the lack of faith of environmentalists in humanity's ability to use its technology to solve these problems. So for organizations like the American Enterprise Institute, geoengineering doesn't represent the danger of technological hubris, but is an expression of human mastery over nature. So you can see how geoengineering, as opposed to reducing carbon dioxide emissions and shifting to renewable energy technologies, represents an affirmation of their view of the world, of humankind, of the free enterprise system. It's a sort of bizarre twist. So here we have these organizations which for years have been vigorously arguing that there is no such thing as human-induced climate change, and then along come these proposals for geoengineering as a response to human-induced climate change. They say, that's the kind of cure to a problem which we previously said didn't exist, but that's the kind of cure we're willing to swallow. So let's have some.
We are talking with author Clive Hamilton about his new book, Earth Masters, and due to time limitations, we won't be going into the technologies to suck carbon dioxide out of the air. People, you're going to have to buy the book to get that. But Clive, I would love to see you write a series of popular articles from this book to get these facts out more widely, or have you already done that?
I've done a few, and they can be found on the internet. I'm also going to be doing a tour in the United States and Canada in the next two or three weeks, and so I imagine more of those kinds of articles will be appearing in easily accessible formats for people.
His website is clivehamilton.com. The book is Earth Masters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering from Yale University Press. I admit it made me so angry at one point I had to toss it down partway through and go out for a walk. But Clive, you're very patient as you explain some of these kind of crazy things that are going on
behind the scenes. It's gathering a lot of momentum as the climate science becomes more alarming and we go into a next warming spike. The calls to geoengineer the planet will become public and loud, and we need a really vigorous public debate so that it's not left to the powerful to protect their interests at the expense of everyone else.
Listeners, now it's up to you to spread the word about this and get people educated, because in his book, Clive shows polls that say most people don't even know this is happening, that the debate is even happening, and we need to know more about it. I'm Alex Smith. I highly recommend you follow up with Clive Hamilton's book, Earth Masters. Thank you so much, Clive.
Thanks, Alex.
In the last year, scientists discovered a climate record going back over 3 million years. Long beyond the ice core records of 800,000 years. Research led by Professor Julie Brigham Grett from the University of Massachusetts Amherst drastically changes our understanding of the world. Drilling into a lake in the Russian Arctic created from a meteor strike ages ago, she found several periods, where the Arctic was up to 8 degrees warmer than today. That despite carbon dioxide levels thought to be similar to or below today's 400 parts per million. The Greenland ice sheets have repeatedly shrunk to half their current size. The West Antarctic ice sheet completely disappeared 1.1 million years ago. The sea level was tens of meters higher than today. All this, not with carbon levels like the 600 parts per million and above, projected by politicians and planners as we burn fossil fuels, it appears we may have already arrived at greenhouse gas levels sufficient to drastically warm the poles, make sea ice history, melt Greenland and parts of Antarctica, and flood coastal areas around the world. All that may only be a matter of time. Here is a selection of key clips recorded from a YouTube video presentation by Dr. Julie Brigham Grett at Amherst in the summer of 2012, almost a year ago, and yet hardly anyone has heard of these startling findings.
So everything you see here in this diagram from stage 5 on is absolutely new. No one's ever seen this before in the Arctic in a continuous record from the land. We know from looking at this stage 5 here, 125,000 years ago, the Arctic was a little warmer than now. Globally, we were 1 or 2 degrees warmer than present. The Arctic may have been 2 or 3 or 4 degrees warmer than present. And scientists agree now that the Greenland ice sheet at that time was probably 40 to 50% of its present size. So we can see what the Arctic does in a warmer world. So let's look at stage 11 at 410,000 years ago. And if we take this little interval right here and expand it out, this goes from 450,000 to 380,000 years here. So we've blown up stage 11. So let's look at that in terms of the vegetation around there. And on the left, I have color-coded. The red here is just trees and shrubs. When there's lots of trees in the Arctic, you know it's got to be warm. And the cooler intervals here in blue. So this is, again, stage 11. This is the pollen, preservation of the pollen that records the vegetation at the time by Pat Anderson at the University of Washington and Tolya Loshkin in Magadan. Their pollen records then have been transferred into a biomodel by Pavel Terezov, which allows us then to reconstruct paleotemperatures. And what this shows is that through the interval of stage 11, the climate was in fact 8 degrees warmer than present in summer. That's astounding. Nobody's ever seen this before. So this was astounding that not only was it warm, it was warmer than 5E when that previous interglacial. This is not what we had expected. Let's look at another one here. This now is in the center of this long stack from 3.6 million down to the present. And here we're looking at an event at 1.1 million called Marine Isotope Stage 31. We highlighted this because we knew from the Anduril record in Antarctica that during this time, this was the last well-documented time when the West Antarctic ice sheet had disappeared. So we wanted to say, well, what happened in the Arctic at the same time? What happened at the other end, at the other polar region? So we went in and looked at that particularly warm interval. And here again is a similar diagram, the paleomagnetic stack, and take this tiny interval here and expand it out. We looked at the pollen again, looked at the biome data, and again we got summer temperatures that are in excess of 6 or 7 degrees warmer than present. Not quite as warm as stage 11, but certainly much warmer than present during this time. So what can we gather from stage 31? Why was it warmer? What was driving that? It's very difficult. Once we go beyond the Epica ice cores, back beyond 800,000 years ago, we don't have a direct measure of CO2. So other scientists like Panusha here at Lamont Doherty has produced a paper where she suggested in stage 31 that the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere may have been in the range of 300 to 325. There's some error bars on those estimates. So it's possible that the carbon dioxide of the atmosphere was warmer during this particular time. We would expect a normal interglacial level to be about 280 parts per mil. So this is a little warmer, a little higher than what we would expect. If we look at from the southern hemisphere to the equator to the northern hemisphere here, we can also see that due to the changes in the Earth's orbit, the orbit around the sun, the tilt of the Earth, and the season in which we're closest to the sun, those influence also the energy coming into the upper atmosphere. And we can see that, in fact, during this stage 31, that, in fact, we were getting about 50 watts per meter squared greater input from the sun at that time. So we could see that there was a Milankovitch, shall we say, or orbital forcing part to this. So we wanted to then say, well, how does that link with Antarctica here? But I want you to notice that, look, there's several places here going back, and there's this M2 interval is at 3.2 million, when there are other times when the West Antarctic ice sheet disappeared. Now, this was an amazing accomplishment for Andrill to be able to demonstrate that the West Antarctic ice sheet was not a stable phenomenon, that, in fact, it is vulnerable and able to come and go. Let me bring that back to Lake Elgigikki now. This diagram is simply our proxy going back from 0 to 2.8 million. And if we zero in on this one, this is stage 31, stage 11, the last interglacial here, and the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, comparing these four different warm periods. What I want to bring your attention to is this diagram shows changes in vegetation, but down here is a biome reconstruction of the July temperature for these four different interglacials, and we're living in this one right now. And then this is also mean annual precipitation. And what I want mainly to see here is that both isotope stage 31 and 11 were much warmer and much wetter than anything we've seen in the Arctic before. This is an absolutely unprecedented record. We didn't expect it, and it certainly was a big surprise for us to see this, but it certainly seems to be holding up really well. So what it means is that Greenland is not only just this ice sheet that sits there no matter what the North Atlantic does. In fact, probably comes and goes and has come and gone much more frequently than any of us had imagined. Now, stage 11 and 31 are not isolated. There are other, what we're calling super interglacials in the Lake Elgigikki record. So with that, I want to end by summarizing, first of all, that the Elgigikki record is offering us a glimpse for the very first time in one location. Lots of surprises. The first of all being that we have extreme warmth many, many times throughout the last few million years. And this extreme warmth has major implications probably for the stability of the Greenland ice sheet and also for the sea ice history of the Arctic. That, in fact, it may be much easier to get rid of that sea ice than we thought before.
Thank you, Julie. Any questions or comments?
So in stage 31 at 1.1 million, yes, we see dark coniferous forests come back to the lake.
But is it there now?
Because no.
Because the carbon dioxide is the same, you said, right?
No, but let's say it's coming. I mean, if you look at all across the north, tree line is marching north. The shrub tundra is starting to move into the open tundra regions. Even though we're at approaching 400 parts per mil now, the Earth system has to catch up. Richard Alley has said this before that, hey, Greenland is still thinking decades ago. Greenland hasn't even caught up to where we are now. And so the transition to actually see the vegetation move will take many, many decades.
That was University of Massachusetts Amherst Professor Julie Brigham Grett presenting results from research at Lake Elgigigitin on the eastern tip of Siberia in the Russian Arctic. Search for her video on YouTube or find that link in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Now we know the world will never be the same. Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org.
Get on your bike, sit on the seat, put your feet on the pedals, and ride it all around, ride it all around. Get on your bike, sit on the seat.
Quick quiz. What way of getting around is growing faster than any mode of transport in the history of the planet? If you said cars, motorbikes, or skateboards, no. The right answer is bike sharing. It's almost enough to give us hope. Here to brighten our day with news about the wave of carbon-friendly bicycle travel around the world is Janet Larson. She's the Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute. Janet, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Well, before we get to that sharing part, is there anywhere in modern cities to use these bikes safely without being run down by cars?
Oh, certainly. I think cities around the globe are trying to figure out how to make the bicycle a more integrated part of their transportation schemes. And to do that, that means increasing bicycle lanes, increasing bicycle paths, having separated cycle tracks alongside traffic but separated by bollards or permanent cones so that cyclists can cycle in comfort and know they have a part of the road, which cyclists have always asked cars to share the road, and now cities are trying to make it even easier for them to do so.
I was always in love with a setup in Amsterdam where they have separate bike paths that aren't part of the sidewalk, they aren't part of the roads, they're like just separate little paths that run right through the city.
Exactly. Amsterdam has long been a cycling leader. Copenhagen is another city people point to where the traffic lights are timed in what they call a green wave so that at a normal cycling speed, you can go through intersection after intersection after intersection, always hitting a green light while you ride along the separated safe cycle track. So it's very exciting what a number of European cities are doing to make it easier for people to get around on two wheels. And right now in Copenhagen, over 35% of trips are made on bicycles. I think Amsterdam's even slightly higher. So it's clearly it's working.
Right. I've been to Amsterdam and I've looked down the main streets of the city at 9:30 in the morning, for example. You hardly see a car. Everybody's using the transit and they're using their bikes. Well, there's plenty of bike action in North America and we will get to that. But I'd like to hear a little bit more about Copenhagen, what their plan was. And I heard that they've shut it down after 17 years. What's going to replace it? Talk to us about that, would you?
Well, Amsterdam sort of kicked off the bike-sharing universe. Back in the 60s, there was a group that left 50-some bicyclists in various parts of the city scattered around. They were painted bright white. Copenhagen took off after that, and in several Danish cities along with Copenhagen, they had bicycles where they were placed around the city. Some were for free. Some had a system where you could put in a coin, not very much money at all, and check out a bicycle, return it to another dock. And in Copenhagen, that is called Bicyklen, which means city bike, and they had over 1,000 bicycles on the street for 17 years, and just in the end of 2012, they shut down that program. Then there was an announcement that it would not be replaced right away because the city was having trouble getting funding, and the outroar was enormous, and so City Hall had to backpedal, and now they are planning to get a modern system on the streets this year, we hope. And when I say a modern bike sharing system, instead of a coin deposit system, it would be based probably on a smart card or smart lock technology where people can sign up with a membership, usually using a credit card, and you get your own code or your membership key, and you can use that to check in and out bicycles. And that's a way to generally cut down on the number of bikes that are stolen, disappeared, vandalized because it's associated with your membership card. So that's how Copenhagen's ready to move forward into the next generation of bike sharing.
That was a problem. I remember with those white bikes in Amsterdam, they were pretty ugly, they were pretty basic, and they worked great, but people loaded them up in trucks and sold them off in Eastern Europe. You mentioned in your release that there's also ways that they could put special parts that can't be replaced or other ways to avoid this problem of bike stealing.
Exactly. As bike sharing has evolved, it's gone from just painting bikes colors, which then could easily be repainted and sold on the black market, or they put on container ships and ending up in Africa or anywhere in the world. Now, the new ones, generally, new programs opening up have pretty distinctive-looking bikes. The parts are unique to those bikes so that you can't just take your regular old tools and disassemble it and then use those parts on any other bike. So they have very little value except in the system. That's the way that most of the cities opening new programs are going now.
And what's happening with bike sharing in France?
Well, France is interesting because France does not have that same kind of long-held cycling culture that the Netherlands or Denmark has, where people just use bikes to get around day to day. In France, the car is in most of the cities is much more prevalent, but it was France that ushered the world into, we call this modern era of bike sharing. In 1998, when the advertising company Clear Channel opened the world's first public computerized bike program with 200 bikes in the city of Rennes. And then in 2005, France's third largest city, Lyon, opened a program called Vélov that had 1,500 bikes at 100 automated self-service docking stations, and Lyon's program was enormously successful. Just within the first year, the city saw bicycle ridership increase 44%, and the program was deemed to be a success about getting people out of their cars. You'd see the bikes everywhere around Lyon, and that led to the opening of possibly the world's most well-known bike-sharing program, Vélib, in Paris, which opened in 2007. And Vélib has been incredibly popular among Parisians and tourists alike. Vélib opened in 2007 with 10,000 bicycles and very quickly doubled. They now have over 2,000 bikes in their fleet. And this was an innovative program. It was the city of Paris entered into a 10-year contract with the advertising firm JC Deco. JC Deco would be in charge of getting the bikes on the street and operating the program, maintaining it, in exchange for street-side advertising space so they could put up billboards for their clients around the city in exchange for running this program for the city. And since 2007, there have been over 130 million trips on the Vélib bicycles. People come back from Paris and say, the bikes were everywhere. And 10 years ago, people really weren't biking around Paris that much. But now people have joined the program, realize it's possible to get to and from their workplaces or the cafe on a bicycle, and it's just really changed the culture overall. You know, still, city acknowledges there's room to grow. Bicycling had been about less than a 1% share of all trips before the Vélib opened, and now it's about 3% of all trips. So it's a great growth, but Paris realizes it can go farther. And its current mayor, Bertrand Delanoë, he is a huge champion of bicycles. In fact, he said that the automobile no longer has a place in the big city of our times. And so he's moving forward, developing new bike lanes and paths. They're going to have 700 kilometers of bike lanes by the end of next year. And they've reduced speed limits in the inner part of the city, making it much more friendly for people to bike around without worrying about getting hit by a car. There's dedicated bus lanes so that buses can move around more efficiently as well. And the bike sharing system really complements that bus, the subway, the mass transit, because it solves what transportation planners call the first mile and the last mile problem. You can jump on a bike, get yourself to a bus station or a train station, ride the bus or train to your place of work or as close to it as you can get, and then you can hop on another bike if you have to travel another mile or so to get to your office. So people have had great luck doing it, and you don't have to dress yourself in spandex and lycra to do it. People are doing it in high heels with their fancy purses and scarves, and it's really revolutionized Parisian transport.
I just love hearing about this. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Janet Larson, Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the new bicycle revolution. Well, there's another aspect to this, and I'm thinking about the country of Spain. Now, they're going through tremendous economic difficulties at the time, very high unemployment, about 26%. It's over 50% for young people there, and bicycles are a much better way to get around. So in a way, if you can develop your bicycle transport system, you're also developing resiliency for difficult times and helping the people who need it the most.
That's a great point. The bike is, you know, once you have a bike, there's no gasoline to fuel it with. The operating costs are very small. Repairs are far, you know, you could buy a new bike for what a typical auto repair would cost if you needed to. And then the bike sharing system is just another way if to even get around ownership of a bicycle. Somebody else is maintaining it. Somebody else is pumping up the tires. You just pay a relatively modest annual membership fee, and then you have access. You're able to get around. So if you're job hunting, looking for a job, you can use the bike to get there. So it's great for young people who might not have a driver's license, or anybody who can't afford a car, and then more generally people who decide they don't want to be burdened by a personal automobile that they then have to figure out where to park and take care of. So the bike sharing is really great, particularly for these dense cities and then our urbanizing world as a whole.
I run into a lot of young people who tell me, there's just no way I can afford a car right now. And even if I could, I'd rather spend the money on lattes and other things, you know, or pay for the new house that I want. So they're just not buying a car. They're not getting a driver's license. And the bike is the way they're going. I think that's progress.
Oh, I think so, definitely. It used to be sort of a rite of passage. You get your car and then you go out and cruise the boulevard. And that's how you meet up with your friends. And today, you know, there's smartphones, there's the internet, that's how people are socializing. People are busy, they want to make the most of their commuting time. So if you can, you know, hop on a bike, then get to a metro system where then you can sit in the metro and read your iPhone or your iPad and then jump off and get on another bike and get where you need to go, you don't have to waste time behind the wheel. And it's freeing. It's also, it increases, I think, the well-being and the feeling of connection with a community when you're on a bike versus a car. You often are going slower, although I guess I must say in cities that are plagued by congestion, oftentimes you can get where you need to go faster in a bike than you can in a car. But you're looking around at your surroundings. I bike from my home in Northeast Washington, D.C. to my office in Northwest Washington, D.C. And when I'm stopped at a light, you know, you chat with the other cyclist next to you and say good morning. And it just really increases the social fabric of a community. It's just such a more human scale thing than to be trapped inside your car.
Out of the boxes and into the peoplescape. Janet Larson, lay some statistics on us. How many cities have bike sharing projects? How many bikes? How fast is it growing?
Well, this was something that really surprised us when we at Earth Policy Institute, we tried to track the number of cities and countries with bike sharing programs. And it seems like every week there's new cities and programs being added, but worldwide there's almost 49 countries now with advanced bike sharing programs, more than 500 cities, and the combined fleet is over 500,000 bicycles. It's growing faster than any other form of transportation in human history. It's really started in Europe, but now that is spreading and North America is finally getting on board, our number of programs in the United States is set to double within the next year or two.
I'm going to be asking you about specific parts of the United States, but before we get there, I want to ask, is this just a fad among richer countries? What is happening in Mexico, for example, or in Asia?
Oh, well, so start with Latin America. Mexico City opened a bike sharing program a few years ago, and when they did, they quickly had to establish a wait list because they got more membership requests than they thought the system could accommodate. Mexico City, if you've been there, you know that the traffic is just horrendous. It's hard to imagine being on a bicycle there, but the city now is working to try to have its bicycle infrastructure match the interest of in cycling. They have a famous event on Sundays in Mexico City where a lot of the major streets are shut down to cars and you get 15,000 or more people out on bicycles, families, young people, old people out on the cycles enjoying the sight, enjoying the streets. So I think they're really trying to boost the culture there and the bike share is just a part of it. In several other Latin American countries, I think there's a dozen or so programs in Latin America. Brazil has a few programs, including in Sao Paulo, where there's actually two separate companies that have established bike share. Colombia has a program. Quito, Ecuador has one. But if you want to see where bike share is really booming, you look at Asia. The biggest program in the world now is in Wuhan, China, that has it's a city of 9 million people, and they have 90,000 shared bikes in their bike share system. It's enormous. The second largest one is in Hangzhou, which has almost 70,000 bicycles in its scheme, and you see them everywhere. You know, China has long been known as the bicycle kingdom. It's the world's leading bicycle manufacturer and exporter. You picture Chinese cities on the bike, but in recent decades, the car had really taken over, and I think these bike sharing schemes are the city planners and the people's way of saying, you know, wait, give us back our two wheels. Let us get around better, because they realized that in big cities like Beijing and Shanghai, people were just spending hours stuck behind the wheel in a traffic jam and not getting anywhere they needed to go. So combining some of their new bus rapid transit systems with fast-moving buses with bike sharing systems, I think, is the way to go, and China is going gangbusters.
Yeah, it makes me sad to think about what happened in China. In the early 1990s, we saw that video of throngs of commuters filling the streets, biking into work, and it had to be so healthy for the people. Now, you hardly want to breathe the air because the same polluting car culture from America and pushed by the same car companies like General Motors has kind of filled up the Chinese streets. I wonder, is that car culture beginning to fail them?
Oh, it's certainly not working. It's not working for the China, you know, that Western car-centered model. It's not going to work in the developing countries. Ultimately, it's failed us here in the West as well. Yet, when I was in Beijing a few years ago and talking to young people, they said, yes, traffic's horrible, but, you know, when I can afford it, I want to get a car. I don't feel like it's fully permeated society, but I think the recent incidences where the air pollution has been just so choking, that may be starting to change people's minds. You know, that's not just automobiles, that's also their coal-fired power plants and whatnot. But I think people have got a glimpse of what could happen when you have clear sky days after they hosted the Olympics in Beijing. And so now perhaps more people will start to try to ask for that on a day-to-day basis.
Well, as you say, they've got a history of the bike culture, and I'm hoping that they can turn it around and bring it back. It's going to be better for everybody and for the climate. Another whole aspect of this is bike messengers and inner city deliveries. We have a small fleet of tricycle freight bikes operating in downtown Vancouver. They're making small deliveries to retail stores. Did you happen to look at that?
We have looked at that, and the bike messenger culture is just amazing. I mean, in New York City, you want to deliver a document from one office to another. The bicycle is certainly the best way to do it. We also have a big fleet of them here in the U.S. In fact, one of the big bike sharing companies called B-Cycle is doing a trial with a utility trike as part of its bike sharing fleet to allow people to perhaps carry goods as well as just be a mode of personal transit. So it's not only the best way to move things around in many cities, but the bike sharing programs are realizing too. People need to, sometimes you need to haul stuff, but bikes can help you do that. In fact, some of the bike sharing programs are experimenting with movable docking stations, because one of the problems that is sort of inherent in the bike sharing world is that sometimes people will just take a bike one way. So the programs have to do some rebalancing, move bikes around. Like in Paris, they were finding people would more often bike downhill than they would bike uphill. So there does have to be some movement of the fleet back.
And you mentioned New York. Is there anything else exciting happening there for bike culture?
Yes. New York City will be rolling out in May, most likely, what will become the biggest bike sharing system in the United States. They ultimately want to get up to 10,000 bicycles citywide, if not larger, but they'll start with a smaller rollout of about just over 5,000 bikes this spring. And they opened up their registration for memberships just the other week, and within 24 or 30 hours, they had 5,000 people sign up for these bikes that are not even available yet. So there's huge pent-up demand in New York City for this bike-sharing program. And over the last few years, Mayor Bloomberg has done a lot to extend New York's bike lane network as well. So it's getting much easier to ride around the city on a bicycle, and riders will soon be able to do it on these bikes. New York system is called City Bike. It's sponsored by Citibank, and the stations are up. They had a lot of delays in part because of technology and supply chain problems, and then Hurricane Sandy damaged some of the infrastructure. So I think cyclists in New York have been waiting and waiting and waiting, and now they'll soon be able to get on their bikes and ride them.
Well, I guess this is the big news that you bring. It's not just that bicycles are sharing the road, but that we're sharing the bikes. And I have heard through the interview several suggestions on why you would want to share one rather than just own your own. You don't have to park it at home. You don't have to protect it all the time. But why are you thinking that bike sharing is the way to go rather than private bike ownership?
Well, it's not an either-or thing. I think they work well in concert. In fact, anecdotally, talking to a lot of people I know in Washington, D.C. who have signed up for our Capital Bike Share, most of us who are members also have our own bikes, but it's just a way to add extra flexibility to your commute. It may be pouring rain in the morning, so you may take the subway or a bus to your office, but then when the sun comes out in the afternoon, you want to be able to jump on a bike and get to your softball game or happy hour or to pick up your kid from daycare. And then you can jump on the bike and do that. And then maybe you pick up your kid, but you don't want to take your kid on the bike yet. So you jump back on a bus or the subway system. So it's just a way to have a much more flexible transit system. And that's what a lot of the bike share operators really consider themselves, their transit. So they can be just part of a network within a city. And then it really complements bike ownership. In fact, some of the bicycle retailers had been worried about what's going to happen. You open this program, how are we going to sell any bikes? But in several of the cities that have studied it, including Washington, D.C. and San Antonio, Texas, they actually found that sales of private bikes also increased after the introduction of a bike sharing system. I think in part because people tried it out. It was like a gateway drug or something. And they said, wow, this is a great way to get along. I need my own bike. Or people saw more cyclists on the road and decided, you know, they wanted to jump in and do it too. So it works really well with existing cyclists often sign up to give themselves more flexibility because your bike's not always with you when you need it. And then it gets new people into cycling as well.
Well, what are you doing with all this information and how can people find it?
On our website, earthpolicy.org, people can see our article about bike sharing around the world, complete with a big data set listing the countries and places you can find programs around the world. And that's what we have at earthpolicy.org. There's also a great resource done by Paul DeMayo and Russell Medin called the Bike Share blog and the Bike Share World Map, and I highly recommend that people check them out because there you can see on a Google map where there's bike sharing programs all around the world, not just existing ones, but where cities are exploring them. And if your city is not yet on the Bike Share World Map, I would recommend that people who are excited about it contact their local officials and see what's being done, because I've talked to city planners in a number of cities, and almost every single one is starting to look at this. And so I think they need to hear more enthusiasm that there really is an interest in bike sharing, because it's worked for large cities like Paris, but it's also working in tiny ones like Tulsa, Oklahoma, of all places, was the first modern solar-powered bike sharing program in the United States in a tiny town. So it can work on all sorts of scales.
Our guest has been Janet Larson, the Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute. This Bicycle Update is part of a series on the positive news coming from the Institute, and it covers everything from clean energy to maybe climate-friendly diet plans. And it's called Plan B, as advanced by the Institute's founder, Lester Brown. Track it down at earthpolicy.org. Janet, I appreciate so much good news for a change.
It's great to talk about bicycling.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can find links for this program in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Please support Radio EcoShock if you can at our website, ecoshock.org, and grab lots of our free MP3 downloads of past programs. Are we out of time? Find out next week as I look into human extinction.